Hello, you're very welcome to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM, the programme and podcast for teachers, policymakers and everyone interested in teaching and learning. I'm Sean Delaney and you can download hundreds of Inside Education podcasts at seandelaney.com. I have a wonderful guest for you to meet this week. Professor Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot is a sociologist of education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, where she studies the culture of schools, the broad ecology of education, and the relationship between human development and social change. She pioneered portraiture as a research method. Professor Lawrence Lightfoot has written 10 books, including The Good High School, Portraits of Character and Culture, and The Essential Conversation, What Parents and Teachers Can Learn from Each Other. When she retires, she will be the first African-American woman in the history of Harvard University to have an endowed professorship named in her honour. In 2017, she was asked to present a keynote talk at the annual conference of the American Educational Research Association. Although she agreed at the time to do an interview with me for Inside Education, it only became possible to record it last month. Her keynote address in 2017 centred on view, voice and visibility. So I began by asking Professor Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot to tell me what her central message was to the educators who were present.
One of the things that I was trying to do was reframe the way we think about the connections between educational research and practice. And I was trying to get researchers at the American Educational Research Association to think about what it actually means to have an inclusive, democratic, diverse educational community and how we can reach more people, more children, more students within that. So the visibility piece, for example, was that everyone in a classroom, in a school, should feel seen, should be known, should be visible. And it was looking at the fact that a lot of people, when they talk about diversity, they really mean tokenism, right? They mean one of us who's different in the midst of all of us who are the same. And I was saying, that's not the kind of visibility I'm talking about, because tokenism is one of those things in which you are both dealing with feeling invisible and being hyper-visible at the same time. And I was saying, let's think about creating educational environments in which everyone is visible and doesn't have to stand for a group, doesn't have to stick out as different, but is threaded through the educational scene. Everyone should have voice, right? We should be listening for voices. And so this was an effort to get both practitioners to think about what this means, but also how do we as researchers begin to see these things? One of the pieces of my work which came through in that speech, which is important, is this notion of goodness in education. That so much of the research, educational research or social scientific research, has been preoccupied with pathology, with disease, with weakness. And one of the things I was saying in this talk was that I really believe that that kind of orientation inevitably gets us just thinking about what's wrong and doesn't allow us to see all those things that are right, that should be supported, that should be nourished and nurtured.
Can you give an example of a pathological approach to education research?
Well, I think research who goes out into schools, particularly schools in under-resourced communities, and finds over and over again failure, right? But usually based on some kind of standardized test. And one of the things that in the past we recognized in the 60s, we called that blaming the victim, right? Right? Because it was these kids who got blamed for not measuring up. And I think if you go in with the question, what is wrong here? How can we remedy what is wrong here? And you understand why people would ask what is wrong here, because what is diseased, it's easier to treat a disease rather than to kind of sort of say what's healthy and robust and good and strong. Just treat the disease and remedy the problem. But that means that we are distracted from looking at anything that has the potential for developing and growing into something good. And it means in the process, too, that those people who were engaged in teaching and learning through that kind of pathological lens, that lens that's preoccupied with disease and weakness, that those people are diminished in our eyes as well, that they don't have a chance to show their strong stuff.
So if researchers were to reframe the way they do their work, how might they approach their work differently?
Well, it sounds as if it's not a big difference, but if you go in and ask the question, which says, what is strong here? What is worthy here? What's useful to save here? You look at things that are very, very differently, right? And you might even be using different methodological tools as a way of trying to document that. So it's not a trivial change. It turns out to be a big change when you ask those questions. I would say that does not mean romanticizing or idealizing what's there. It means asking that question and then documenting what you see, you know, and some of it will be good, but a lot of it will be imperfect and flawed because that's the human condition. You look at any human enterprise and it's flawed in some kind of ways. As a matter of fact, I would argue that beginning with the question about what's strong here, what's good here, what works here, allows us more landscape to discover. That kind of generous question allows us more room to discover even the imperfections, to name them, and to begin to work on them.
And going back to what you said about children being visible in the classroom, I'm sure some researchers would be shocked to think that they're not seeing some people in the classroom. And I'm thinking of somebody like Steiner, who advised teachers to go through every child in their class at night, and whoever they forgot or whoever didn't come to mind easily, that child should get extra attention the next day. Mm-hmm. Is that what you have in mind?
That's a lovely thought. That's a lovely way of thinking about it. Yeah. I think another way is that when you're having, because there are kids who drive you crazy, you know, where the relationship is difficult and where you're just really mostly experiencing them as troublesome, both for themselves and their peers, for the whole sort of classroom culture. And to realize that maybe you go home that night and insist in your own mind that you find something really redemptive about them, that there's something that they do that is really good and strong and worthy. And even that shift of purview, I think, is helpful.
You began your address last year by listing US and global atrocities that have made news from 9/11 onwards. Why do educators and teachers in particular need to attend to such events?
Well, I think, you know, schooling and teaching and learning don't occur in a vacuum. They occur in the world around us. And at this point in the US history, we have a very, very toxic environment, in which someone is leading the country who is hierarchical and prejudicial, is in lots of ways malicious, and I think dangerous. And that environment surrounds children, surrounds teachers, and is a source of worry for a lot of folks within schools and outside of schools. And it's silly to imagine that the broader ecology is, it doesn't have a huge influence on what happens inside of schools. And as a matter of fact, I teach a course here called The Ecology of Education, which recognizes the spheres surrounding the social, cultural, historical, economic spheres surrounding what might be happening inside a classroom and the influences that has in shaping what happens inside this classroom culture, inside the teaching learning experience. So I think when I began my recitation of all of the atrocities, not just in the US, but I think I was talking about worldwide, that signal danger, that signal fragility, that are treacherous. You know, I'm saying we teachers and learners exist within that frame, and we can't imagine education an education that's truly an education that in some ways doesn't attend even explicitly to that environment.
None of us would want to put our head in the sand, but is there a risk in doing that, that you could, because these atrocities are so horrendous and horrible, that you could actually get into a spiral of pessimism? Would you have any concerns about that if you were to handle them, you know, with children in a classroom setting?
Well, I think, first of all, it is hard not to sort of get submerged into sort of even not just pessimism, but cynicism, right? And I think that one of the things that to think about, I think, as teachers is the sort of developmental level of the students you're dealing with and how much of this conversation can go on, right? And with very young children, with high school age folks, and that there is a way in which we need to teach. I mean, if you look historically, you know, this is for, I think about high school students, I think about undergraduates in this case, but who can read the history, Howard Zinn's history of the U.S., for example, which really talks about sort of cycles of down and up times and the ways in which we prevail, the human condition prevails through these very, very difficult times. And I think it's useful to put these times in historical context for students so that they recognize the resilience of human history and the capacity of humans to participate in transforming what's happening now and make it better. But yes, I think that there is a danger. There is absolutely a danger I think the cynicism teachers need to guard always, guard their students, protect their students from an environment that's total cynicism.
Your background is in sociology, mm-hmm. and sometimes I think, at least in Ireland, and I'm not sure elsewhere, that sociology is the poor relation in education discourse, with philosophy and psychology especially having the upper hand. What do you think that analysing education through a sociological lens contributes to our understanding of education?
Well, when I talked about the broader ecology, there's a way in which sociologists see the social context within which things take place. From my point of view, context is everything. We don't know how to interpret human experience without seeing it embedded in context. And I thought you were going to compare sociology to psychology, you know, and so much of psychological kind of discourse and inquiry into education is decontextualized, right? As a matter of fact, if you look at laboratory work, it is important to sort of see it as the ways in which laboratory research functions. You see context as a distraction. You know, you don't see it as the best resource for understanding human behavior. That's what I believe, that context, you have to see things in context. And you have to recognize the ways in which context shapes, whether it's an institutional context, a cultural context, a social context, a relational context, an ecological context. It shapes human behavior. It shapes teaching and learning. And it's also shaped by individuals. In other words, it isn't that these are all powerful institutions that determine the norms and values we live by and behaviors we live by, because these are also human constructions, and we can shape our institutions, we can shape our context as well. So I think sociology offers us the chance to see both the power of the context and the power of the individual to shape that context as well.
And if we take that a step further then into practice, in their daily work, how can teachers ensure that their teaching is sensitive to or informed by a sociological perspective?
Well, I think one of the things that I've studied pretty closely is the relationship between families and schools, right? And the need for family engagement that is supportive of children's learning and achievement in school. So teachers who embrace a sociological perspective will realize that in order to be good teachers of these students in their classroom, they have to really get to know the cultural context from which their students come, the familial context from which their students come, the road they travel to get to school, the values they bring with them. And they need to find a way to relate to those as important as Moll talks about it, funds of knowledge that they can tap into as teachers, right? And this isn't just a relational strategy to get to know children better. This is, I think, in support of the development of a curriculum which is much more relevant and ultimately much more revelatory for students as well.
And would you even go as far as, say, talking to children about, you know, tell me about how you walked to school this morning? Or, like, in other words, I'm thinking of situations where the children may be coming from a background that is quite different to the teachers. And how can a teacher become sensitive to backgrounds that they may have no conception of?
Yes. I think one of the things to do is that families, parents need to be welcomed into schools, for sure, in meaningful ways. But I also think that there are all kinds of assignments that can encourage children to speak autobiographically, to speak about their journey from home to school, for sure, but also where their people come from, who their parents are, who their grandparents are, and to begin in a place that values not just the child, but the child's parents and grandparents and ancestry and the child's neighborhood as resources and gifts that they bring with them into the school. And you really want to support those and enhance those and amplify those as part of the curriculum.
I'd like to move on now to your research, and particularly the research method you developed, which is portraiture. That grew out of an experience you had of having your portrait created. What is portraiture as a form of research?
Well, portraiture, social science portraiture, is something which I have pioneered, which is an effort to blend literary narrative and empirical description. So art and science, aesthetics and empiricism, to document the world around us or the people or the relationships or the processes or even a concept by observing, interviewing, document analysis, participant observation, whatever all the kind of mélange of strategies are that qualitative researchers use, but with an eye towards not only documenting it systematically and rigorously like any good researcher would, but artfully and, dare I say, beautifully, with an effort to not only inform the audience of readers about what the phenomena that you're studying, but to move them, to inspire them, to provoke them. So it is narrative work. It's storytelling. It begins with the presumption that in the particular resides the general, that in the particular resides the universal. So if you tell a particular story that places that particular story in time and in context, with all of its complexity and subtlety and groundedness, that you, the reader, reading that, are likely to feel identified with something or someone in that story, right? You're likely to say, isn't that interesting? I would have felt, I feel that same way too. You know, I wish I could do that too. That's also a dream of mine. You know, that makes me angry too. And in that identification, you feel implicated in the story. The story becomes yours. Portraiture, visual portraiture, of course, is made up of the portraitist, right, the artist, the person who's sitting for the portrait. And then that painting is put on the wall of a museum. And we viewers, visitors to the museum, come in and we look at this portrait. So that the portraiture is the coming together of three views: the view of the portraitist, the artist, the person who's sitting for the portrait, their sort of sense of self and who they are. But also, the portrait is only complete with the third pair of eyes. And so it's the same with social science portraiture, that it is only complete when the reader comes to it and sees themselves in the piece and offers an interpretation of the work.
And how does the researcher choose a candidate for portraiture?
Depending upon what the question is. Like all good research, it begins with the research question. What are you studying? And then that leads to, how do you find a person who might represent that phenomenon or an institution or something. It's not based on random samples or robust general trends. You usually are trying to find someone who embodies something about the question that you're asking, and then you are further investigating it. So with the book that we are looking at in front of us, the book Exit, which is my penultimate book, my next to last book, I was interested in finding people from a variety of backgrounds who were going through a major exit and documenting their experience taking that exit. So in this book, there's a young 16-year-old Iranian man who's making an exit from a war-torn country and coming to the U.S. There is a middle-aged gay man, actually political activist, gay rights activist, who's talking about making the exit from the closet, right, and that experience of exit. There is a young boy who's being bullied in school mercilessly and bullied and finding a way, ultimately, finally, after so much abuse, of exiting that toxic scene and how he manages that and how his parents manage that with him, etc. So I'm going to talk to people who are making these very different kinds of exits. And usually it's what sociologists call a snowball sample, right? In other words, I find someone who's making an exit who's particularly thoughtful and reflective and insightful about this exit that they're making, and I spend time with them, exploring that, documenting that, watching them, witnessing them, interviewing them. And then when we're finished, I say, by the way, do you know anyone else who's making, and not the same kind, but an interesting exit? And they give me, they say, oh, actually, I know of a person whose husband is dying, at the moment, and they're paying a lot of attention to his exit. And as a matter of fact, that's the last chapter of this book is called Grace, and it is about death.
The method of portraiture research, how does it differ from an approach like, say, a case study or grounded theory? Is it the aesthetic nature, or is there more to it that's different?
Well, I think it shares a lot in common to those other qualitative methodologies, the grounded theory approach or the case method or ethnography. These are all under the umbrella of phenomenological research, where you're really trying to document people's experience, right, in context. And usually you're documenting a process. It's not input-output work, So there are lots of ways in which portraiture shares these things in common. But it is very different in the sense that there is this focus on goodness, right? It is very different in that there is this effort to speak to broad and diverse audiences through this kind of narrative interpretive work. It's different that there's this connection between art or literary narrative and empirical description. So there's a lot of attention paid to design, presentation, aesthetic of the work, designed to get more people involved in reading it, frankly, and involved in a larger public conversation. And so there are, those kinds of differences for sure.
When you've touched on this already, but when you focus in depth on one person, you're always going to come across blemishes.
Yeah.
So how do you handle those, first of all, in creating the portrait, but also from an ethical point of view?
Well, it's interesting. If you go in and truly listen without judgment to people, it's likely that they will open up and tell you a lot of things. And if it's really a human experience, they will tell you some extraordinary, wonderful, amazing things, and they will tell you some traumatic and sad things as well. And if, in fact, you can present those sort of holistically and in a complex and subtle way, understanding that the wholeness encompasses those things, and understanding it comes through listening very carefully without judgment, it's usually just fine. Now, there are things that people tell me. First of all, people are welcome to turn off the tape recorder whenever that they want. I can tell you that in decades and decades, for at least 4 decades of doing this sort of deep, soulful work. I have never had a person say, turn off the tape recorder. I have, however, many times decided I'm not going to say this in the work. I mean, that this is something that isn't there for public consumption and shouldn't be. So I've made those decisions. And then if I'm using the name of a person and they can be identified, they also get the opportunity to see the work before it goes to the publisher and to tell me what they think are its factual errors or any places in the manuscript where they think it might be hurtful. So there is that ethical process as well of review.
I had the good fortune almost two decades ago to take a class from you. And one thing I remember you saying was something along the lines of, I'm not interested in the facts, I want the truth. Mm-hmm. Does that apparent paradox represent your thinking? And could you elaborate a little bit on it?
I don't remember saying that, but it sounds like me. Oh, my goodness. I think that I'm very much interested in people's truths. And I don't think that that's just made up of facts. And I might even say another thing, the story is more interesting than the facts and the ways in which people tell the story. So I'm interested in the ways in which people have different truths about even the same fact, you know. And these truths or these stories that they tell about those facts tell me something about them, about who they are, about their perspective, about their meaning-making, about their vision of the world, about what strikes them as funny and what strikes them as horrible, you know. And I'm eager to capture that more than to really chronicle in any kind of way the facts. So I think that's what I was meaning.
And that was Professor Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot from Harvard University bringing this week's Inside Education to a close. I want to thank her for her time in recording the interview. To download over 300 Inside Education podcasts, go to seandelaney.com and click on the podcast tab. My book about teaching, Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have, is available from all good bookshops, and you can ask for it in your local library. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.